You're listening to Midday on WNYC. I'm Kai Wright. In 1889, Cesar Ritz declared to his wife that the Eiffel Tower was, quote, the crowning achievement of the 19th century. Now, at the time, much of the world considered it an utter failure. The tower would, of course, go on to usher in the Age of Steel, and Ritz, meanwhile, would team up with chef Auguste Escoffier to usher in the modern age of hospitality. His very name has become synonymous with luxury. You know, Ritz Carlton. That's our guy. And the best-selling author Luke Barr dissects this history in his new book, Ritz and Escoffier, The Hotelier, The Chef, and the Rise of the Leisure Class. Luke Barr tells the riveting tale of how two men from humble beginnings opened up the comforts of the aristocracy for anyone who was willing to pay the bill. The book is published by Clarkson and Potter, and I'm pleased that it brings Luke Barr to our show. Welcome, Luke.
Thank you for having me.
I got a lot of French there in my mouth. I've got to get used to for this conversation.
But yes.
that's where modern luxury comes from, right?
Right.
So, who is Cesar Ritz?
Cesar Ritz was a working class guy born in Switzerland in the Alps. Herding sheep and cows and so forth. And at age 12, 13, became an apprentice in a restaurant and as a waiter. So he came up through restaurants as a waiter. Auguste Escoffier, meanwhile, was born in France, and he came up also at age 13, around then becoming an apprentice in the kitchen as a chef. And so these two men coming from that kind of working class background, starting very young, working in restaurants, and then eventually Ritz in hotels. Eventually they met, and in my book takes place in the 1890s when they kind of, in my mind, invented the modern luxury hotel, and also the modern conception of the restaurant. The modern restaurant that we now take for granted was kind of invented at that moment.
And neither of them grew up in the aristocracy, but they both came of age in the Victorian era, right?
Right.
I mean, help us understand that context. What was high society like at the time?
Well, I mean, it was a highly stratified society. You know, for example, you know, people, I just want to fast forward to my book. Like I said, it takes place in the 1890s, mm-hmm. when so much is changing. All of these rules about the stratification and the aristocracy and class and so forth are all undergoing a tremendous change in the 1890s. Of course, that wasn't because of Cesar Ritz and Auguste Escoffier and because they opened the Savoy Hotel in London, but the success of that hotel and that restaurant really was a reflection of those changes. So, for example, you know, in the 1860s, 70s, and 80s, you entertained at home. Respectable women did not go out in public and eat in restaurants with their husbands. The husbands went off to their private clubs in London, and they entertained at home. In the 1890s, women are becoming more mobile. Women are going out in public. There's all kinds of political, social changes happening at the time. In London, it happened at the Savoy. The Savoy became the kind of center of a new cosmopolitan London, where you had different kinds of people mingling and mixing in a quasi-public place for the first time.
So introduce us to the Savoy. This is really the idea of a guy named Richard Doyley Carte. Right.
Richard Doyley Carte is a fascinating character. He was English. He was a theater producer, and he was the producer of the Gilbert and Sullivan comic operas. Incredibly successful, these were in the 70s and 80s. He opened the Savoy Theater in London in 1880. Something like that, 10 years before he had the idea to open a hotel. So he opened this theater in London, the Savoy, which was the most modern theater of the time. And he also was in, you know, these operas were very popular in the United States as well. So there was traveling theater companies that were going to America. And he and his wife went to America. And when they came to America, they found, wow, these hotels that we're staying at here in New York or San Francisco are far more modern. They have elevators. They had electricity. This was unheard of in London at the time. So he thought,
because it was the, why was it so unheard of at the time?
Well, because I'm not a historian of why exactly America had electricity and elevators in San Francisco.
But it was a technology question.
It was a technology. Yes, exactly. And he thought, I'm going to go to London and open a state-of-the-art hotel in London that will have elevators and electricity. And that was the Savoy. And he had a ton of money because these operas were so successful. He was very wealthy. So he built this hotel. And then he realized he also needed someone to run this hotel. And he had stayed at one of Ritz's hotels, a much smaller hotel on the Côte d'Azur in France, and realized this is the guy that I can get to come and run my hotel in a sophisticated continental way. So he had this feeling that he needed to seduce the wealthy people of London to come to this hotel, yeah. because after all, they were all, as I just said, entertaining at home or going to their private clubs.
It was a crazy idea that they would go to a hotel right. and go out to dinner. And the Savoy was, I mean, it was, to be clear, it was this massive, unprecedented thing. It wasn't just technology and elevators, right? I mean, it also had like mini bathrooms.
Well, the bathrooms are a crucial point. I mean, there were large hotels in London at the time, absolutely. But those, I mean, I think I found the another very recent hotel that opened just before the Savoy opened in London had 400 rooms, guest rooms, and it had a total of 4 bathrooms. Okay, so, and when Richard Doyle Carte was building the Savoy, he had bathrooms in every suite of rooms had a private bathroom. And that was unheard of. I mean, the builder, this is possibly apocryphal, but the builder at the time that Doyle Carte had hired said, who are you expecting to come to this hotel? Are you going to have amphibian guests? Why do they need all this water in their rooms and run, you know, baths and so forth? But of course, he was onto something because that was another thing that was changing. You know, people were traveling much more. There was more mobility in general. People were traveling without their entire household staffs. I mean, I don't know if you've seen, you know, Downton Abbey-esque right. kind of, where you're going to London for the season and you're going to stay for 3 months and you're going to bring your whole staff with you.
Luke, that's how I travel.
Right? Yeah, hey. exactly. So this new era of more mobility, traveling without your butler, you know, that's what other thing people said. It was a great compliment that Ritz, when he heard this, someone came to the Savoy and said, I don't need to travel with my butler anymore because everything I need is right here at this hotel. So that was it was a reflection of this new mobility. And I just want to get to also the restaurant was equally important. I mean, right. the centerpiece of this thing in a lot of ways was the restaurant.
And so this is what Escoffier is doing.
That's right.
Coming up with the idea of
exactly.
the restaurant. So what about it is changing in that moment? What is it that he's doing?
Well, there's a few things. I mean, he's keep in mind, what's considered to be great food at this point is, of course, French food. So, you know, everyone is serving French food, but Escoffier is doing a kind of a simplified, he's simplifying the French classics. He's trying to make things a little bit lighter. Less things on the plate that are sort of decorative. For example, he said no more and everything on the plate has to be edible. Okay, because previously there was a sort of a thing where you would have these platters come out with these grand kind of monument food as monument that you would kind of look at and admire and then you would eat it, but it wasn't all edible. So he really changed that, and there was a reason behind that too, which was he had refined a system in the kitchen to kind of, it was like kind of a division of labor so that when an order comes into the kitchen, in Escoffier's kitchen, the order gets divided up amongst the various groups within the kitchen so that the grill man is doing the grill and the saucier is making the sauce and the fish person. So every dish is divided, is sort of subdivided, and then it comes back together again. And if you do that, you can produce, this is, by the way, how a contemporary kitchen works.
Well,
in a restaurant.
Right. And if anybody who's been to one of these restaurants now where you sit at the chef's table and you watch
right.
the open kitchen and you watch this dance
right.
and you see, it's just taken for granted, which you've just described.
Right.
But
right.
that didn't exist before.
Well, I mean, it sort of existed. I'm not going to say he invented it out of whole cloth, but he did refine that division of labor, and he changed, furthermore, the kind of the culture of the kitchen. Kitchens, when Escoffier was coming up, when he was 14, he was a very small man. And kitchens were hot and they were smoky. And the men in the kitchens were all drinking beer all day. So by the end of the day, they were, you know, half drunk and everyone was shouting. So Escoffier, who was this kind of refined person, he wanted his kitchen to be quiet and calm. No alcohol was allowed. You know, he tried to keep things organized and serene. So that's what he brought to the kitchen, and that included also this refining the organization and the division of labor, which then allows you to produce dishes much more quickly.
So d'Oyly Carte creates the Savoy basically through recruiting these two men to come.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a complication. He creates the Savoy. He tries to get Ritz to come over and run the place. And Ritz, who's 39 years old at this point, says, no, I just finally got independently. I'm running my own hotel. This is in Cannes in the south of France. I don't want to come and be an employee of you. I'm my own man. He had his own investors. He had his own property. And then d'Oyly Carte ran into trouble almost immediately at the Savoy. You know, within 6 months, they were starting to lose money, and he was getting really worried. So he just said to Ritz, whatever, name your price. And Ritz said, okay, I'll come half the time. I'll come for 6 months of the year during the high season, the high social season in London. And for the rest of the year, I'll keep running my own places. And d'Oyly Carte said, great. And then Ritz said, and I'm going to bring my chef, Escoffier, is going to come with me. And d'Oyly Carte said, great. So then they showed up. So they weren't right from the beginning, but almost right from the beginning, they were running the place, and they turned it around. They turned it into this phenomenally successful hotel and restaurant in London, a place where, and I want to emphasize this, I mentioned earlier about women not eating out in public. That changed at the Savoy. Suddenly women were coming to that restaurant. You had nouveau riche Americans showing up at the restaurant. You had Oscar Wilde and the sort of bohemian artists and the opera stars showing up at the restaurant. And you had, because Ritz had this built-in clientele from his years as a hotelier in France and Switzerland, he knew the aristocracy. The Prince of Wales was a regular client of his. So you had this intermingling of the aristocracy, the bohemian types, the rich people, the Americans, all at the Savoy in this restaurant. And I can't emphasize that enough. The idea that you would go to a restaurant to see who else was there, and you might be seen too, to see and be seen. That again feels very modern. That's how restaurants are sometimes, you know, we've all experienced that. But that was new at that moment in London.
And was that on purpose? Did Ritz and Escoffier say, you know, this is what we want?
It was. He had a very deliberate sense of the theatricality of the restaurant experience. This is another thing that we're used to now. You go to a restaurant now, they've hired an interior decorator to design the space exactly the way they want it. He was very focused on lighting, for example. He did these experiments with his wife, who is a crucial figure, Marie Ritz, where he sat her down in front of an electric light. You have to remember, electric lighting was a little bit new, and it was kind of glaring.
It was a show itself, right?
Yes, and so, but he did this experiment with lampshades. What is the most flattering color of lampshade that I can put on this sort of bright electric bulb that will make a woman look most beautiful at the restaurant? And he came up with this kind of apricot peach color, which was the most flattering and the sort of soft light that would make everyone in the restaurant appear at their best. And another example of this was when he was opening, you know, he installed at great expense a set of stairs into the restaurant, so that when you would be making this kind of grand entrance, coming down the stairs into the space. And it was a conscious decision to sort of make that entering the restaurant into a kind of theatrical moment for a woman in her dress or whatever.
And you're creating experience. Right. We all know now, you know, that first step into something really creates an experience for you.
Exactly.
So do you think, particularly thinking about the way they mix the aristocracy with nouveau riche, do you think that the fact that both of them were outsiders to the aristocracy shaped their understanding of all of this?
I think in a lot of ways that's the most crucial thing that I realize. I mean, that no one else could have done it, as I guess is how I think about it. I think you had to be an outsider to do what they did. You have to remember that Ritz in particular grew up looking at the aristocracy and admiring the aristocracy and hoping that the Prince of Wales would come to his hotel and just, you know, he was a fan of that and of that world, and he loved it. But of course he was an outsider. It was not his world, but he still looked at it with great longing, and he was very self-conscious about his humble past. For example, his hands and his feet. He was convinced that he had peasant hands and feet, which were too large.
Wow.
And he fussed over his hands and his fingernails all the time.
Because it meant he was a worker.
Yes.
And you're not supposed to
and
be a
he
worker.
Wore his shoes a half size too small. his whole life.
Wow.
Can you imagine that? I mean, that because he wanted to be seen as not as a peasant. So yes, I do think that the ambition, the sheer ambition that these guys had, they had to be outsiders to want to do that. And I think that the creation of the luxury hotel, the luxury restaurant, you know, in London, then in Paris at the Ritz, is a kind of, they were creating a kind of a simulation, a fantasy, really, when you think about it. It was a fantasy of what a wealthy aristocratic person, that what their house would look like. That's sort of what the hotel was meant to be like. And I think that fantasy and that simulacrum, let's say, of wealth and luxury, only someone like Ritz and Escoffier could have created that.
How important was the new American money to that, to people?
It was very important. There was a lot of money in America, and people were traveling. People were coming over on these ocean liners more and more, and they were flowing into Europe, and they had nowhere to stay. So, you know, we haven't even mentioned that at the heart of my book is this scandal where both Escoffier and Ritz are fired from the Savoy. And the reason for that is because, yeah, there was all this money flowing into London. London, by the way, the largest city in the world at the time, right, by far. I mean, right, much bigger than New York City, much bigger than Beijing or any city in the world. London was the center of an empire, and there was tons of money there. So they had created the Savoy, great success. And then Ritz started being approached by these very wealthy investors who were not the aristocracy. They were the nouveau riche. This was new money, industrialists, South African diamond mining magnates, whatever.
Right.
And they come to him and say, hey, Ritz, we're doing this Savoy thing is great. Let's open a hotel in Cairo. We really need a great hotel there. We need one in. So they had these fantasies of opening luxury hotels. And indeed, they put up the money and started exploring the idea of opening a hotel in Paris. So Ritz was at the Savoy, an employee of Richard Doyle Cart, and he's entertaining his potential investors in his new business where he's going to open a hotel in Paris called the Ritz. And he's giving them free drinks and he's giving them dinner and he's entertaining his investors. And Richard Doyle Cart is like, wait a sec, this is my employee. He's starting a rival hotel company right under my nose here. Not to mention that Escoffier in the kitchen was taking kickbacks and taking, you know, all kinds of shenanigans going on. Maybe this was par for the course in the 1890s.
Kickbacks for what? What do you take kickbacks for?
The suppliers were bringing food into the kitchen and then also bringing, both Ritz and Escoffier had their private kitchens fully supplied by the suppliers, right, of the restaurant. But also Escoffier was on, you know, there was testimony given in the legal proceedings that ensued, which I talk about in the book. You know, he was taking a cut of every single wine deal or food deal that was happening, right, in the restaurant. Escoffier, this is the other thing, psychologically speaking, these guys made that place successful. They came in 1890 and they made the Savoy what it was. So they started acting like they owned the place. It's not really that surprising when you think about it. And so when you act like an owner, you give people drinks. You allow people to,
right,
a line of credit. You want a line of credit and you could pay later? No problem. They found these vast debts that, you know, that people had been given lines of credit, that all of this kind of stuff. But it really boiled down to, on a psychological level, these working class guys started acting like they owned the place, but they didn't. So they were fired.
Right. But they went on to own the place, metaphorically speaking.
Absolutely, yes.
In our culture.
Yes.
It's a fascinating history. I've been speaking with Luc Barr, author of the new book, Ritz and Escoffier, the Hotelier. I can never say it, Luc. Ritz and Escoffier, the Hotelier, the Chef, and the Rise of the Leisure Class, the story of how we got to what we understand as modern luxury today. Thanks for joining us, Luc.
Thank you for having me.